Welcome to the Bible study. This is part 14 in our series on Joseph, and we hope that today's Bible study will be a blessing to you. And we're in the middle of Genesis 42, and we've been looking at the first visit by the brothers to Joseph to get food. And we're in Genesis 42, and we were looking at verses 18 to 20, Joseph's response to them. And we read there in Genesis 42, 18 to 20, and this is after the brethren had spent 3 days in jail. They had heard from Joseph earlier, 3 days earlier, that nine of them were going to spend time in jail, and then one of them was going to go home and get their brother and bring him back so they all could be let go. And then Joseph is changing the plan to only one of them staying in jail. And so we read in verses 18 to 20, Joseph said unto them the third day, this is after they spent 3 days in jail, do this and live, for I fear God. If ye be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses, but bring your youngest brother unto me, so shall your words be verified, and ye shall not die. And they did so. And so this is after they had spent, the ten of them had spent 3 days in jail, and they were under the understanding that nine of them were going to stay in jail, and one of them was going to go back and fetch the brother. But that would have been difficult for one of them to go by himself. And also, what about food for the family? And so it was a little bit unreasonable on Joseph's part, and so he changes it so one of them can stay bound as kind of a down payment or deposit, ensuring that they'll come back. And then the other nine can go home, and that'll be more safe for them. And it will also make it so that they can bring food for the family. It's more practical. As I mentioned earlier, there's a theme that we see in this, whereas Joseph is maneuvering and manipulating. We'll see this especially when we come back to the second visit, that Joseph is maneuvering the situation to get Benjamin down to him. And we can see historically why he would do that, because that was his full brother, probably the one real brother he had, and he wanted to see him. And so we could understand that family love. And as we talked about in the last study or the study before, is that Joseph is a picture of our Lord Jesus Christ, and he had a great love for the true believers, represented by Benjamin, the son of my right hand, which the name Benjamin means son of my right hand. And out of the corporate family of God, represented by the family of Jacob, those ten brothers, maybe the ten is the completeness of the corporate people of God. There's one tenth in there. There's one brother that fits. Actually, that doesn't quite fit because there's 11 brothers. Benjamin wasn't there, so that idea doesn't fit too well. But at least out of the corporate family of God, this was the point that we talked about before, out of the corporate family of God, there is that remnant, the true believer, represented by Benjamin, for whom Christ paid for their sins. Christ has demonstrated or loved them in a great way to pay for their sins, and has a great desire for them. And so Christ has done a whole lot, sending the gospel into the world, paying for their sins, coming into this world and being mistreated, and everything he has done so he could have that, those true believers represented by Benjamin. I think that is the gospel picture in there. But in these verses, Genesis 42, 18 to 20, last time when we finished up, I was talking about that phrase, I fear God, or that sentence, I fear God. You see that back in verse 18, that he says, I fear God. And this is a big concept in the Bible, fearing God. And it's used in different ways, and it's very detailed. And so I didn't want to go through a detailed study of it. For example, in some places, God says about the unsaved, there's no fear of God before their eyes. And we know that they're not really worried about God. They don't really want to obey God. They don't really believe there's a judgment day coming. They don't fear God in that sense. And the true believers, as we know, there's many verses that talk about how they fear God. They know that they deserve hell, and they tremble before God, and yet they know that Christ has paid for their sins, but yet they know that apart from the grace of God, they would be on their way to hell also. And so they fear God, and a big part of that is eschewing or turning away from evil. And so that is a big part of it. But there's also the sense of fearing God in the sense of I fear God, I may not be saved, but I fear God, and that restrains me from committing evil. Last time, I believe it was, we looked at Genesis 20, where Abraham said, I thought there was no fear of God in this place. And he told Sarah that she had to say, he is my brother, so they wouldn't kill him. In other words, he thought there'd be no restraint of sin in the hearts of these people, and so they didn't have any kind of fear of God, and so they would just go ahead and kill him and take her if they thought that she was his husband. But that's another way of using fear God in the sense of, I'm not saved, but I fear God in the sense that, well, there might be a God there, and so it restrains me in my sinfulness. And this, at least this is a part of what he's saying there. I'm restrained, Joseph saying, I'm restrained from being too unreasonable, leaving all nine of you locked up in there and trying to send one home by himself and keeping food from your families. I'm restrained because I fear God. I have a fear of God, and that's that must be sin doing that, so therefore I'll just keep one of you bound and send the other nine back with food. That's an idea. And I wanted to look at a couple other places where this idea of fearing God is used, like, for example, in Leviticus 25:43. Read there. And there's quite a few verses like this one, but this is ties into another passage I want to look at in a few minutes, or look at next. Leviticus 25:43. Thou shalt not rule over him, this is a servant, with rigor. Okay, let's see. This is talking about a servant. Let's go back to verse 40. But as an hired servant and as a sojourner, he shall be with thee and shall serve thee unto the year of Jubilee. This is someone who's waxen poor, and he's had to come like an indentured servant, an old term that we had, that somebody who had to sell himself as a servant or a slave until he could pay his debt. But as an hired servant, as in a sojourner, he shall be with thee and shall serve thee until the year of Jubilee. And then that it was every 50 years, and then they could be set free. And that was a gospel picture of the fact that Christ is our Jubilee. And upon salvation, he sets us free. And finally, at the rapture, he sets us free from a sinful body and everything. And we'll be with him forevermore in the fullest possible sense. Verse 41, and then shall he depart from thee, both he and his children with him, and shall return unto his own family, and unto the possession of his fathers shall he return. And that is the gospel picture of the new heaven and new earth. For they are my servants, which I brought forth out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as bondmen. And that idea is that you're cast away. The unsaved are finally bondmen of the law of God. They're in bondage to their sin. They're subject to the law of God, and they're cast away in hell, paying for their debt, which they never complete. They're eternally bondmen. Verse 43. This is the verse that I wanted to get to, but thou shalt not rule over him with rigor, but shall fear thy God. In other words, you fear God, you're restrained, recognizing that God is a judge. You may be a judge over this man, but there is a higher judge that's judge over you, and so you better watch out what you're doing. And maybe that's the right way of the right thinking of that, is that if you're too harsh on this servant here, remember, there's a judge over you, and you fear God knowing that he's judge over you and you're subject to him. And that's the idea, I think, of that Joseph was communicating with them back in Genesis 42, is that he recognized that there is finally God is the judge, and I fear the fact that he is a judge over me also, and so I'm not going to rule over you with rigor, to leave nine of you bound and send one of you back, maybe with no food. And that's an idea. And then there's one other place, there are a lot of other places that talks about this, but there's one other place I wanted to look at, which was Luke 18. And this is, you're probably familiar with this passage, the unjust judge. Let's turn over to Luke 18. And Luke 18 is a very good passage in this part of Luke. There's a number of passages, parables, examples where God is encouraging us to pray for mercy, to pray for mercy. And that's a very important part of this, Luke 18, starting in verse 1, that if an unjust judge, this unjust judge finally listens to this poor widow, if an unjust judge, somebody who doesn't fear God or regard man, if he will finally listen to persistence, what about a just judge that does have a concern for mankind? Will not he somehow listen? And so that's an encouragement to pray without ceasing for mercy from God. Let's read Luke 18, starting in verse 1. And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint. So you see that there is Jesus telling us right up front that this is given that we might always pray and not to faint. And for the big thing we want to pray for is salvation for ourselves and for others and about any kind of problem, remembering, O Lord, let thy will be done. Reading from verse 2, saying, there was in a city a judge which feared not God. So here's this idea of not fearing God, or versus fearing God. Feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, Avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God, nor regard man, because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith. And shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? And you see that twice this passage says about this judge that he doesn't fear God. That he says that, you know, though I fear not God, nor regard man, in verse 4. And so God is emphasizing this man, you know, some people will operate in a reasonable way or operate with compassion or restraint because they fear that there is a God and they're afraid of that, and that will restrain them because they're fearful that there might really be a God that will judge them on the last day, and that will restrain them. Or there's another kind of people that they have some regard for their fellow man. Either they're trying to do that because they want to be self-righteous or whatever, how could I be as a decent person and not have some regard for my fellow man? And that will motivate them. And these two things can be a motivator to have us be somewhat compassionate upon others. But here God gives the illustration of someone that doesn't have any fear of God and doesn't have any regard for man, and yet this man showed compassion because of the continual persistence of this widow. And so God is emphasizing, the big teaching of this passage is God is emphasizing that you continue to pray to God because God does regard man and God does regard the law of God and seek God for salvation. But the part I wanted to tie in is the fact that fearing God restrains this fear of God, even if we're not saved, recognizing that there may be a God that is a judge over us, restrains man in his sinfulness. And this is, I think, the idea that Joseph was communicating back in Genesis 42. Let's go back to that. Genesis 42, verse 18, is that I fear God. I recognize that there is a God, and therefore I'm not going to rule over you with rigor. I fear God. And we read in verse 18, Genesis 42, verse 18, Joseph said unto them the third day, do this and live, for I fear God. In other words, I fear God, I respect God, and therefore I'm not going to deal with you with rigor. I'm not going to be too rigorous on you. And that may have been a clue, or maybe it should have been a clue to these men that Joseph, he's somewhat different. You know, this is consistent with how we were brought up in the family of Jacob, Jehovah God, and that we were to fear God. And maybe that would have been a clue to them, or maybe not. But anyways, let's move on. Let's go on to verses 21 and 22 here. And so he's going to let nine of them go home, but he's going to keep one of them bound. Simeon here, he's going to keep him bound and make him stay until they bring back the younger brother, which they know is going to be a problem because that younger brother, Benjamin, his dad wants to keep him because that was the last remaining son of his favorite wife, or the wife that he served 7 years for, Rachel. Okay, so we read in verses 21 and 22, and they said one to another, We are truly, this is the brethren, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. And Reuben answered them, saying, spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear. Therefore, behold, also his blood is required. So this is interesting how guilty these men must have felt about what they had done to their brother Joseph. Remember, 21 years has passed since then. If you go back to 21 years, you're like, for in our day, that'd be like 1989. Think about things that you did back in 1989 if you were here in 1989. And this is the amount of time that's passed for them, and they're still feeling guilty about this. This was a very wrong thing that they did, and God was had a plan in all of this, but still yet this was a very wrong thing, and this is coming back to their memory that they're thinking about their brother 21 years ago, what they had done to their brother, and they remember that they saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us and would not hear. And so they remember that. Another possibility is, you know, they're in Egypt now, and maybe that helped remind them of the fact that they sold Joseph into Egypt. It's interesting, this situation here, the way they're thinking about how they had done this evil thing, and now that they're kind of identifying this trouble that they're having now as a recompense, so to speak, for what happened, because they're in this bad situation, and they're thinking, ooh, you know, we're guilty, truly we're guilty concerning our brother. So they're really identifying this bad situation as if God is bringing this bad situation upon them because of what they had done to their brother. And then Reuben emphasizes that at the end of his statement in verse 22, behold, also his blood is required. And so their thinking is that this is in their conversation that this is somehow a punishment for what they had done 21 years earlier. And it's a little bit similar to what we read in Numbers 32:23. It's a rough approximation of that. Let's turn over to Numbers 32:23. And this is where Moses is talking to the 2.5 tribes that were going to stay on the east side of Jordan, and they had made promises that they would come and they could have the east of Jordan, that land over there, but they had to come and help their other brethren drive out the inhabitants as they were supposed to, and then they could come back. And then it says, like, for example, in the land be, let's see, verse 21, and will go all of you armed over Jordan before Jehovah until he hath driven out his enemies from before him, and the land be subdued before Jehovah. Then afterward you shall return and be guiltless before Jehovah and before Israel, and this land shall be your possession before Jehovah. Moses is telling them, if you fulfill this program that God allowed, that you come over and you help your brethren drive out the inhabitants, because this was the land that they were supposed to possess, then afterward you can come back and have that land of Gilead. And if they don't do that, it says in verse 23, but if you will not do so, behold, ye have sinned against Jehovah, and be sure your sin will find you out. And this may be the kind of thinking that they're thinking now, that their sin has found them out, and they had sinned 21 years ago, and their sin finally is finding them out. But that isn't really, this analogy isn't really the biblical application, because we know from the Bible that people can do all kinds of bad things in this world and pass through their sojourn in this world and apparently get away with it, with nothing happening to them in this world. But the real application of Numbers 32:23, that your sin will find you out, is that there is a judgment day finally coming, and it may be next year. There is a judgment day coming, and at that point we will, if we're not saved, we will have to stand before the judgment seat of God, and that is when our sin will find us out. That is when our sin will find us out, and that is the real biblical application of Numbers 32:23 for anyone who sinned any time in the time of history, that they will have to answer to God on that day, and that will be an awful time. And so it's important that the important upshot is that we're saved, that we're prepared to meet God either next year or any time. It could be tomorrow. And God could take any one of us next week. A million people are not going to be here next Sunday, and a lot of them didn't know that they weren't going to make it through the week. So it's important. Salvation's important both for next year or any year and for next week. So let's go back to Genesis 42:21. Genesis 42:21. And so they said, let me talk a little bit more about the biblical application of this idea. And they said one to another, we are verily or we are truly guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear. Therefore is this distress come upon us. And actually, because these men were the corporate people of God, so to speak, they were Israel, they were the family that God was working with, this is really a chastisement from God, like we read in Hebrews 12. I'm not going to turn there, but you're familiar with that, where God sends chastisement to his people. And the primary application of Hebrews 12 is towards a true believer, because if we don't receive any kind of chastisement, that means we're illegitimate and we're not a real son. And there are people that go through this world and have no problems at all, and that actually for them, according to Hebrews 12, is an assurance that they're not a true believer. Of course, there are people that are in bad situations that have a lot of troubles, and that's because this world is cursed, and that itself doesn't show that you are a true believer. But if you are a true believer, God is going to be chastising us, that he's going to be working on us to make us more conformed to the image of Christ, so that we're more like the Lord Jesus, and we're humble, and we have the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and we have the fruit of the Spirit, and God is refining us. It's a little bit like John 15, where he said that, you know, everyone that bears fruit, that the Father comes, that Christ is the vine, and you are the branches, and the ones that don't bear fruit are trimmed off and they wither. Those are the unsaved that are identified with Christ but never became saved. They're trimmed away. But those that do bear fruit, they're pruned so they bear more fruit. And that is a chastisement, that God prunes us that we might bear more fruit. And so this is a chastisement. And another point I wanted to make was that God does, remember, if you think about national Israel, like in the book of Judges and other places, God was chastising them. They were serving other gods, and God would chastise them and bring them back to him. And most of them were not saved, but because they were his corporate people, he was still dealing with them in a way and still chastising them, really applying Hebrews 12, in a sense, to them to try to bring them back unto him and help them to see their need of him as a Savior. So the idea of chastisement also has that kind of application to his corporate people. And so this is what this worked out, this situation that we have with Joseph also worked as a chastisement to help these men grow in grace. Some of them were saved probably, and maybe many of them never did become saved, but to help them to recognize their relationship with Jehovah God of the Bible, the God of their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that they might cry out to him for mercy. So we read in verse 21, it says that if we say that they recognize that Joseph besought them. We read in Genesis 42:21 that Joseph besought them. And that's really the word supplicate or mercy. It's translated mercy or gracious or sometimes supplicate. And that is really the sense here, is that Joseph was supplicating, besought. He was supplicating, begging for mercy, and they would show no mercy. This is really, verse 21 is really, it says here, when he besought us, begged us, supplicated, or begged for mercy, we would not hear. Joseph was supplicating for mercy, and they would show no mercy. And sadly, this is the condition of unsaved man. Unsaved man by nature does not show mercy to his fellow man when his anger is stimulated. These men, they were angry at him. And if somebody becomes angry, unsaved man becomes angry, this is the nature of unsaved man, that he will not show mercy. And the big part is that when we talk about showing mercy, the big mercy that God wants from the true believer is to point people to the mercy of Christ, the mercy of the gospel, to bring them the gospel that they might know about the mercy of God. But this ties into what we read in James 2:13. Remember, these men, according to verse 21, are recognizing that Joseph was supplicating or begging for mercy, and yet they would not hear. They would not be merciful. And James 2:13 talks about this idea. Let's turn over to James 2:13 for a minute and look at what God says about that right there. James 2:13, "For he shall have judgment without mercy that has showed no mercy, and mercy rejoices against judgment." And what that verse is saying is that the unsaved that have showed no mercy, that God will have judgment upon them without mercy. those are the unsaved that have showed no mercy. And yet on the other side, the true believers, for them, mercy rejoices against judgment. And this is talked about earlier on, that you know, is James chapter 2, as God is pointing the finger about mistreating people, and like in verse 6, do not rich people oppress you, and to oppress other people and blaspheme God. And in verse 13, God is saying that, you know, for those that have showed no mercy, that God will have judgment without mercy, and that's at judgment day, judgment without mercy. But for the other side, for the true believers, mercy rejoices against judgment. And this is reflected in the brothers. They were angry, and they showed, and they were angry. Their pride was impacted by the things that Joseph had done, and they would show no mercy to others. They would show no mercy to Joseph. They had no mercy. And in this verse, James 2:13 says that if we're like them, if we don't have the mercy of Christ that we're trying to share with others, or if that's our nature, that we're not able to show mercy to others, that we're among those that have showed no mercy, then on judgment day, God will have judgment against us without mercy. By the way, there are those people that incorrectly argue that God will not throw the unsaved into hell because he'll be merciful to them somehow, to the unsaved at just judgment day, that he's a merciful God, and so he won't throw anyone to hell. But this verse says that, you know, he's a merciful God now, but when it comes to judgment day and the unsaved, there will be no mercy. So this idea that, well, somehow God is going to be merciful, he won't throw people into hell or this or that, this argument people are making, the Bible says, sadly, at judgment day for the unsaved, there will be no mercy. He shall have judgment without mercy. And so we better not be hoping that somehow we're going to escape hell because God will be merciful to us on the last day. God says in this verse and other places that there will be no mercy on judgment day. And so we want to remember that today is the day of God's mercy. We don't have a promise of tomorrow, but today is the day of God's mercy. So we don't want to let this day go by without pleading for God's salvation for ourselves or for others. And so we've come with the brothers here. Let's go back to Genesis 42, and 21 years have passed for them, and hopefully they've grown in grace, and we see through this little dealing that God has had with them, and that they appear to be growing in grace, and that's the benefit of chastisement, that 21 years ago that they were pretty hardened against Joseph, and now 21 years later they're recognizing the sinfulness, and this will help them to grow in grace and recognize and cry out to God for mercy, and hopefully many of them did become saved. So in verse 22, we're back to Genesis 42, verse 22, and Reuben answered them, saying, "Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child, and ye would not hear? Therefore, behold, also his blood is required." And we see from Reuben's response, it appears from this that Reuben was not involved and did not initially know about the selling of Joseph. This ties into some language we read in Genesis 37. I'm not going to turn there now, but Genesis 37, 21 and 22 and 29 and 30 talk about how apparently Reuben was not involved in that. Reuben wanted to recover Joseph, to take him back to his father. Maybe Reuben felt that since he was the firstborn, he was trying to act kind of as the second head of the family, the firstborn. You know, he was the firstborn, and so he would try to act on behalf in the most responsible way. Or perhaps he was trying to redeem himself from the sin he'd committed with one of Jacob's concubines. And notice he says his blood is required, and the blood has to do with the killing, and so they figured Joseph had been killed. And it's interesting, the idea of his blood is required is expressing what everyone knows, that man is accountable, and the idea is required. In other words, you're required to give an account for that. And Reuben knew that man was accountable to God. Reuben and the other brothers would have been trained in the laws of Jehovah God by their father Jacob, and said they would know that man is accountable to God for his actions. They may not have understood it correctly. They may have thought the accounting somehow happens in this world, But the Bible explains the accounting happens at the judgment throne. But sometimes people get this idea, and there's a lot of this is in the culture of man, that that you're going to give an account somehow in this world by calamities and things that happen in this world, and the Bible indicates that's not the case. If a calamity happens to you, like the blind man that was in John 8, I think it is John 8 or John 9, wasn't blind because of any sin he had done. This was just God's plan for him. Likewise, the rich man in Luke 16 had no problems in this world, and yet he ended up in hell. And so it works both ways. You can have trouble in this world and yet be on a right relationship with God, and yet have or the other way is you can have everything go well for you in this world and you're in big trouble with God. So it can happen either way. So the accounting comes at the judgment throne. It doesn't come in this world, except God may use events in this world to chastise, may use it, which is apparently what he's doing here. But the idea of required is really the idea of accountability, and that comes at the judgment throne. Okay, and also mankind knows that mankind deep down, even apart from any training he has, knows that there is a God. This is taught in Romans chapter 1, and he knows he's guilty before God, and God has given man a conscience that bears witness against him of his sins, and that's taught in Romans chapter 2. And so, in addition to the instruction of their fathers that they had, actually all mankind and the ten brethren have the witness of creation and their own conscience. So let's move on. Genesis 42, continue on in verse 23. So let's read verses 23 to 26. Genesis 42, verses 23 to 26. And they knew not that Joseph understood them. Now see, they're talking amongst themselves, and they probably think like they're in a foreign country, and this man is speaking another language, and so they're just discussing these things in front of each other, in front of him, to each other. And maybe you've been in that. I've been in situations where there's people that speak like Mandarin or something. I have no idea what they're saying, and they're just having a little dialogue in front of themselves, and then they speak to me in English, and they don't think I understand, and they're accurate. I don't understand it, and this is kind of like what they were doing. They were speaking in their Hebrew, and they figured that he didn't understand any of that, but it turns out he did, of course, understand it all. And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter, and he turned himself about from them and wept, and returned to them again and communed with them, and took from them Simeon, and bound him before their eyes. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn, and to restore every man's money into his sack, and to give them provision for the way. And thus did he. And they laded their asses with corn, and departed thence. Okay, so Joseph spoke to them through an interpreter. Otherwise, everyone would have wondered how he knew their language, but this helped to keep the cover on the fact that he was their brother. And in the palace, the Egyptians, in every country's like this, in the palace of Egypt, there were people there who knew languages of the different regions, like people who knew the languages that were spoken in Canaan, and people who knew the languages of other countries, and this way you could communicate. And so when these different people from different countries came up, they would find someone that could communicate with them, and the Hebrew is similar to some of the other languages. It's a language family, and so there would be people that could understand pretty well what these men were saying. And Joseph spake in Egyptian, which is a different kind of language, not really tied into Hebrew, and so that he would be speaking in that, it wouldn't be apparent that he understood what they were saying. But we see in verse 24 that that Joseph had emotion towards them. It was because he wept. He turned from them and wept. And we don't know whether he wept because of his concern for them, or wept because of the kind of the fact that they recognized that they had sinned against him. And so we don't know how much his concern was for them, and how much was it for how they had mistreated him. But he did have some emotion towards them. It was not that he didn't care at all about his half-brothers. He was concerned about them and what they had done, and he will show great compassion upon them later. And so he does have a concern for them, and in returning back, we find in verse 25, he gives them the food, and notice he returns every man his money. Verse 25, then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn, and to restore every man's money into his sack. And so he doesn't want the money, it's his family. He gives them the food for free. He's also giving them provision for the way. So he's given them some extra food for the way. And so he has compassion for them and care for them. He returns their money to them. Joseph never took any money from his family and brothers. His brethren don't know this, that he returned it. And so when they get home, the fact the money has been returned, when they get home and discover this, or discover it along the way, this is going to be a great consternation for them, a great concern for them, especially because Joseph had dealt roughly with them. Now, one thing we might note out of this, something we could note about this, is we notice that Joseph sells the grain to the nations. In verse 6, for example, we read back in Genesis 42, verse 6, and Joseph was the governor over the land, and it was he that sold to all the people of the land. And so he sells the grain to the nations, and yet he gives the grain to his family. And that reminds us, gives the grain without cost to his family. And that reminds us of another gospel picture. We're reminded of a conversation Jesus had with Peter. Remember in Matthew 17, let's turn over to Matthew 17 for a second. Matthew 17, verse 24. Matthew 17 and verse 24. And this is a conversation between this little situation that Peter went through, and then Jesus and Peter have a conversation about this. And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute, and there was a tribute money, there was a half shekel temple tax that everybody had to pay, and that was talked about, I think, back in Exodus 20 or something like that. And there was this half shekel temple tax that they had to pay, and this is called tribute here. And so that there people are wondering whether Jesus paid tribute. Let's read this again, Matthew 17, verse 24. And when they were come to Capernaum, they that received tribute money came to Peter and said, "Doth not your master pay tribute?" He saith, "Yes." And when he was come into the house, Jesus prevented him, saying, "What thinkest thou, Simon? Of whom do the kings of the earth take custom or tribute, of their own children or of strangers?" Peter saith unto him, "Of strangers." Jesus saith unto him, "Then are the children free. Notwithstanding, lest we should offend them, go thou to the sea, and cast a hook, and take up the fish that first cometh up, and when thou hast opened his mouth, thou shalt find a piece of money. Take and give unto them for me and for thee." And you see that this temple tax was a picture of the payment for sins. And so that was a ceremonial law that had to be performed, and just like many other ceremonial laws. And the people were wondering, did Jesus make that payment? And Peter says, yes. You know, he probably didn't really know, but you're stuck in that kind of situation, and you say yes, or maybe he knew that Jesus would never sin, so he had to have paid it because he would not sin. And so he says yes. And then Jesus, just to comfort Peter, Jesus, of course, knows everything that went on. He has them make that payment. He puts the fish, swallows a coin, and of course God will guide it so that when Peter fishes, that first fish that he comes out of the sea will have a coin in there, and that one coin will cover the half for Peter and the half for Jesus. And so, but Jesus gives a key point, is that yes, the people of the world, they have to pay taxes or tribute, but the children are free. The children are free. And this has to do with God, the gospel, is that for the law of God, the payment for the law of God that comes with salvation, that payment is free to the children. Those are the true believers. They, as the family of Jacob, freely receives the grain. It's a picture of the bread of life, a picture of the payment for sins, a picture of the Lord Jesus. And they freely receive that, and that is a picture of the true believers, who are represented by Jacob's family, freely receive the payment for sins and salvation that gives us Christ forevermore. And that is given to them without any payment. They don't have to pay in the true sense, they don't even have to make that half shekel temple tax, because they're free. They're free. That payment was done by Christ, because we are his children. He has taken that payment for us. So we receive the payment for sins, that payment that we owed to pay for our sins. We receive that free. But the nations, they have to make that payment. they have to make that payment. And unfortunately, that payment ends up and you're stuck in hell forevermore, and so you never get out of it. But this wonderful gift, that a gift of God, the salvation, is free without any cost. And it doesn't matter how many times we've rejected the gospel or we rejected the Lord Jesus for decades. It's still possible that God can save us. And we want to remember the thief on the cross. He started out reviling Jesus, yet within a few hours he's asking for salvation. And Jesus gives a wonderful statement in Luke 23:43. And Jesus saith unto him, Verily I say unto thee, today shalt thou be with me in paradise. And this is the wonderful gift of salvation, that even if we've turned our back on the gospel for decades, that hope of salvation, while we're still here and judgment day hasn't come, that hope of salvation is still there. And so I think that is a part of the picture, is Joseph gave the grain free to the family. That's a picture of that God gives the gift of salvation free of charge, and yet the nations, they have to make payment for sins. Okay, let's go back to Genesis 42:25. Genesis 42:25. And let's read that again and move on from there. And Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn, and to restore every man's money into a sack, and to give them provision for the way. And thus did he unto them. And they laded their asses with corn, and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he espied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, My money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, What is this that God hath done unto us? And so, from these verses, we can see that they did not know, the brothers did not know, that Joseph had given their money back. And of course, the fact that there was money in there was going to be a great concern. It didn't occur to them that Joseph had given the money back to them. And so now they're afraid, because he had dealt very harshly with them, and he had taken one of their brothers, and they knew they would have to go back for more food and for Simeon, and who knows what this man might do. This man was very strict, and he was somewhat unpredictable. And so, if you think about it, Joseph must have appeared to them as somewhat erratic, by, you know, claiming they were spies, claiming they came to see the nakedness of the land, putting them all in jail, saying only one could go back, and then 3 days later letting nine of them go back. So probably Joseph appeared as a little bit erratic, a little bit unpredictable, and a tyrant of some kind. So we could understand when they're afraid that when they come back, who knows what he might do to them. And so it said, we read in verse 28, that their heart failed them. And the word failed is normally translated went forth or proceeded. Went forth or proceeded. So it's not like they had heart attacks, heart failure, but their heart, in the sense of their whole being, was concerned. They were afraid of this situation. And notice at the end of verse 28, they recognize God's hand in this. They say, What is this that God hath done unto us? And I think this statement obviously ties into verses 21 and 22. These brothers knew they were guilty before God, and for how they treated God, and how they treated Joseph. And because they were part of the family of God, the corporate family of God, family of Jacob, God was dealing with them through chastisement. So God is dealing with them. Hebrews 12 would fit for them, and God is dealing with them to help correct them and bring them back to God. And God has applied this principle of chastisement repeatedly upon Israel, like I mentioned earlier, in the days of the judges. And even though most of Israel never became saved, God still sent them chastisements. They were still His people, His corporate people. And these chastisements were a care to bring them back to Him. And they would kind of externally bring them back to Him, but their heart, sadly, their heart was still in rebellion into them. And we can kind of turn in our outward strength and what we can do to try to turn back to God. But finally, God has to change the heart, and He changes the heart by coming to indwell us and work in us to will and to do of His good purpose, and which He talks about in Philippians 2, verses 12 and 13. And that is really when salvation happens. That's when we actually turn with our heart towards God, and it's a lasting turning towards Him. Okay, and so we also see that We can recognize that they can see that God's hand was upon them. God's hand, what is this that God hath done unto us? And so they could see this. Now let's continue. Let's read verses 29 to 35. Let's read that and see what this has to say here. And they came unto Jacob their father unto the land of Canaan, and told him of all that befell them, saying, The man who is the Lord of the land spake roughly unto us, and took us for spies of the country. And we said unto him, We are true men, we are no spies. We be 12 brethren, sons of our father, one is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the country, said unto us, Hereby shall I know that ye are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me, and take food for the famine of your households, and be gone, and bring your youngest brother unto me. Then shall I know that ye are no spies, but that ye are true men. So will I deliver you, your brother, and ye shall traffic in the land. And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. Okay, so here the brothers are recounting what happened and parts of the conversation that they had with Joseph. And the fact that God actually recorded this in the Bible means God is placing extra emphasis on this conversation for us. And we see back in verse 30, we see that word roughly again. He spake roughly unto us. And that's the word we studied earlier, where he's very hard. It's normally used in a very severe way. A very severe way. And this shows us that God is emphasizing this again, that this was a very severe way that Joseph dealt with them. And also they told their father of their need to bring Benjamin next time. And this is to help Jacob get ready for giving up Benjamin. And this giving their father this account would also help explain why Simeon was not with them. Recounting this explains why Simeon's not with them and why they needed to take Benjamin on the next trip. And notice in verse 35 that Jacob, here he says in verse 35, that Jacob also is afraid of what the ruler of Egypt might do. We read there, And it came to pass as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack, and when the both is not there, and when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. So both the father, and Jacob, and they were afraid, because they had told him about this man. And so obviously this man seems a little bit unpredictable, and they're worried about what this man might do, and so they're afraid. And Jacob is going to come up in the next verse and say that he's not willing to let them go down. We read in verse 36, And Jacob their father said unto me, Me have ye bereaved of my children. Joseph is not, and Simeon is not, and ye will take Benjamin away. All these things are against me. And Reuben spake unto his father, saying, Slay my two sons, if I bring him not to thee. Deliver him into my hand, and I will bring him again. I will bring him to thee again. And he said, My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is left alone. If mischief or evil befall him by the way in which ye go, then shall ye bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to the grave. And so he's not ready to let his son Benjamin go. Now we're going to find out in the next chapter that he finally recognizes the next year, another year is going to go by, and that he has to let him go. But this is all the time we have for today's study. Next time I want to spend a little bit more time and start off with verse 36 and look at this statement by Jacob. We want to look at that a little bit and compare that with what the Bible says about Jacob's blessings from God. It's an interesting verse here in verse 36. He says, all these things are against me. And we want to think about that for next time, spend a little bit of time on that, and think about the promises God had given to Jacob, and now he's in the middle of some setbacks, but just think about all the blessings that God had promised to Jacob, and perhaps Jacob has taken his eyes off of God there and not really thinking about how God is in charge. And God, even though there's some setbacks here with Simeon, and obviously appears that Joseph was taken, yet there are many, many blessings and promises that God had given to Jacob, and maybe he's taken his eyes off God there. But thank you again for coming, and during the coming week, may the Lord richly bless you.